notes here that maybe will keep me on the track. But it seems to me that all of you might be interested to know, in the first place, how this exhibition of two black women folk artists came about. So I'll tell you that again. I had known for a number of years, probably 30 years,
hey.
visual, and you have to react to the visual, but in many instances, you can't react too well to visual unless you know something of the background that draws an art about. So, what I would like to do in the beginning here is simply to quote myself in this little catalog. You can all read, maybe some of you have read, but this is what folk art is to me. And I'm specifically referring to these two women here. What each has in common is an innate ability to create an idiom that defines the true meaning of folk art, the honest, heartfelt expression of an inventive spirit, untrained in any academic sense. And what makes good folk art is no different from what makes any art good, a visual, aesthetic sensibility that has quality. Everyone has to judge themselves whether they think these or any other art really has quality, but obviously I did, or I wouldn't have done this over. Now, I think it might be of some interest to you to know a little bit about the background. I'm going to treat these two women separately in the beginning, Clementine Hunter and then Ellie Mae Rowe. But to tell you a little bit about each one's background and how, at least to me, that has influenced what she has had to say. Clementine Hunter comes from a very particular section of Louisiana that is near the little town of Natchitoches. And Natchitoches is, if you're geographic for Louisiana, it's not quite in focus. It's about 60 or 70 miles north of Alexandria, Louisiana, and a little to the west. And Alexandria is almost in the center of the state, not counting the fingers that run down into the Gulf of Mexico, the state of Louisiana. And it was a town that was actually a French fort before New Orleans was founded. It came into existence as a French fort in 1714, I believe, and was named a fort to protect the French entries from the Spanish, who were a little farther over in what is now Texas. Well, I won't go into the whole rigmarole of the past history of Cane River, but it kept a great deal of its charm and its particular nature of that particular section of Louisiana. It is not Cajun country at all. But the early settlers were French white landowners and people who had come to the fort. And very early, of course, they had some few slaves. And the real beginning of the Cane River country, as most people know it today, came about through an alliance between the white Frenchman, Claude Thomas Pierre Esquire, and a black slave woman whose name was Marie Therese Quine Quine. If any of you have seen, you know something about this whole background on the little TV tapes out in the gallery about a book about this and about Nellie Mae Rowe. But for the audience today, I thought you might be interested in a slight background on what this whole country is like. They had 10 children between them. She was still a slave. She was owned by another owner. He bought her and freed both her and all the children that he had by her. Now, under slavery laws, any white father who at least recognized his children to that extent was actually the legal possessor. He could buy and sell those children. Well, Louisiana had a particular liberal law insofar as free people of color were concerned. And when he freed these children of his, and this was done with other people too, they were at liberty to be on their own. But as you might well imagine, life in the special indigenous concept in this locality for this particular family of people, the Matoirs. And from the 10 children, a number of them had acquired plantations, and they actually owned slaves to work those plantations. When the Civil War came along, they lost practically everything. Reconstruction was much harder on them than it was on the whites, because the poor whites moved in and took over the morality of the area and sort of suppressed they are commonly called Creoles of color in that area. But the descendants of Matoir, there is no Matoir, and Marie Therese still live in that area today. Many of them, of course, have moved away. And some of the plantations still exist, some of the houses still exist. The Melrose, where Clementine grew up, well, that is after she was 15, she was actually born on an adjoining plantation called Big Hill. She lived there since she was 15. She came to Melrose and first worked as a field hand in the field, and the plantation owners discovered that she was a very good house servant, and she could do all sorts of chores far better than anybody else available. So she quite happily came in to do things like cook and sew. She gardened. She made baskets. She made quilts. She looked after the children. She did all sorts of things. And when, in the late 1930s, just about the time World War II began, not in this country, but in Europe in general, Francois Mignon had come to Melrose for a visit. This is the last 6 weeks he stayed 32 years. But he was instrumental in first being interested in the fact that Clementine Arnold even wanted to paint, and then the fact that she could paint. All these plantation legends are based on stories, and some of them get all out of proportion. And you don't know what's fact and what's fiction in any of this history. But this one is persisted as much as anything about Clementine. It seems that a visiting artist at Melrose, Mrs. Henry, who owned the plantation, she and her husband, but Mrs. Henry had a great interest in all sorts of local lore, both with the Creoles of color and the black and the white French elements who had been in that area. And she was the mistress of Melrose Plantation, which originally had belonged to the Matoirs, the Creole of color Matoirs. They lost it during Reconstruction, and then it went over to the white family, and was owned for two or three generations by white men. But she was interested in bringing writers, authors, and artists to Melrose, simply because she had that interest in that sort of thing. And Lyle Saxon, who was a very well-known Louisiana writer, and Laura Bradford, and even Alexander Wolcott came. And then, I don't know all the artists that came, but the stories of how Clemente started to paint dealt with one, Alberta Kinsey from New Orleans, who had come to paint and Magnolia. And then Alberta Kinsey left. She left behind some tubes of paint that Clemente was cleaning up after in one of these little houses that was in the back of Melrose. And she brought the things around to Francois and said that she believed she could mark a picture, she had something to paint on. Now, obviously, she had taken some interest in these artists that came there and painted and observed what they were doing. So as far as I know, Timothy never painted Magnolia. She did Vineyards, but never Magnolia. Anyway, Francois found a piece of old green, with a shape at one time of green on one side and white on the other. And he gave her this and a little bit of turpentine to thin the paint. And the next morning, he 3/4 of a mile on one of the roads that led into the McCon Road. And this little house was in the McCon Road. And she got well enough recognized, at least in the local area. She had her grandson, who could write a bit, make her a sign. And the sign was very kind of time, but the first one I ever saw was tacked on the side of the house. And it had a fence around it to keep any stock around the house. And the yard was swept clean, few flowers and little circular beds. And the sign said, Clementine Hunter, artist, paint, 25 cents to look, nothing if you buy the ticket. And that was, she had a little time later with some little inflation, the one that we have a picture of says just plain 50 cents to look, and she started peering around the corner. Well, she became well enough known and became popular enough just through selling these few things. And Francois was always promoting them. She did get on television in New Orleans in the early to mid-50s. And there was an article done on her in Look magazine, Reader's Digest, had something, and various other publications. And at the end of the 50s, Hollywood saw this movie in there with a movie that they took, which I saw in the very best movie, I might say, called The Horse Soldier, so it had John Wayne in it. And I remember when seeing it, I could recognize the places that they were, where they were on location. But in place of going really up and down this Cane River Lake, they went in circles around one place, so you'd repeat and see the same scene all the time, which didn't seem to be very good Hollywood tactics, but they did. But the Hollywood people got quite fascinated with her work, and they commenced to buy it for just as many as she could turn out. And the second time I went there, I quoted it in this little catalog that some lady from went there, but I had to be the one that went. Because I was asking if she had any bet. I had a commission to buy from somebody that, some of you knew Lenny Kessel, which was a Western man. Kessel was jumping up and down for 1,700. And so when I was down there, I told him I was getting one, and he wanted a bad size. And I went in, and I asked if she had any bad size. She said, no, she didn't have any bad size at this point, but you come back to ask her, and then I'll have it. So her productivity, you know, picked up. But these are all just sort of interesting little tales that come up about her, and to me they make the painting more fascinating. What I'm going to show you first is a little bit of Cane River country, and just to give you some slight visual idea, this work is not intended to be a slideshow altogether, but in order to make my point, I want to show you this. This is the Cane River Lake. Now, actually, this was Red River in Louisiana that was changed its course in the 1830s. And this river flows, well, it doesn't actually flow, it's dammed up at one end. It's sort of a lake. It's very popular with fishing folks because they keep it dredged out and cleaned out. And also, all of it down this river were these homes where the Creole color lived. Some white, but this is what the look is a bit faded out. This slide was made in the mid-1950s, I think. And here is the principal, used to be the principal hash crop, hop, in the summertime. I had a slide, but it's so faded out. One time they got Chinese geese to weed the cotton. This was before the big machines came in to take over the duties of both the blacks and the geese. Thomas Berry as L. Rose translation, no longer in use. This was taken in the mid-52. It is obviously a late, probably in 1860s or 70s building, but commentary was a very necessary part of translation, because this is where you went to hear gossip and to buy whatever you want to buy before people had cars and could go to town. Melrose is about 18 miles south of this little town of Natchitoches. This is a pretty dark slide, but it's the back end of Yucca, which was the original house at Melrose, and it was either built by Marie Therese or one of her sons, Louis, who built a big house there. It had a gallery all the way across the back, and there's a little room on the far end there, and then on this end, Francois built a little chapel. When we get to the slides on cemetery, I'll show you that, how she interpreted the chapel. And this is what is known as the African House, which is directly in back of the big main house, Melrose. And it definitely has an African influence in its architecture. This was, again, built either at the end of the 18th or the very early part of the 19th century. The lower part is brick, and the upper part is wood. It has this tremendously heavy overhang, as you see. That is, would have been typical of the Congo area where Marie Therese's grandparents came from. Her parents came from Africa. And this is, the sun is so bright on this tin roof, but this is one of the typical small houses along the river that was built of cypress post framework that mud, clay, and Spanish moss and hair was all mixed together as sort of a mortar packed together between those posts. You'll see another one. Here's another typical early house in its sort of last stages of living. Now this is one of the very early houses there, and here you can see the way the mud was packed between the posts. And this one, this is just an 18th century house. It had a dirt floor, filled up, and the post that supports the house, there was no framework underneath it. These posts are simply set in the ground, and they last because it's cypress wood, which is very durable. This is an adjoining plantation to Melrose. I didn't have a photograph directly of Melrose. It was quite similar to this one. This is the Prudence House. And the plantation is called Armida. It has a gallery all the way across the front and down two sides. All of these houses, I'm going to back up here. All of these houses in this region are built more or less on one style. They're based on West Indian vernacular architecture that was introduced in the 18th century in the section of raised pilotis or raised piers. And then they had galleries all around, always across the front, usually around both sides and sometimes in the back. Since the Louisiana humid summers, this kind of architecture to be built to keep it very cool. And when the flood came, the raised attitude of the whole house people if they really needed to go there. She wants to see everybody, and I don't blame her. But she was painting that day when I went in with Mildred's baby. And she had these socks on her hands that finger photo cut out, and Mildred asked her what she was doing that for, and she said, well, it was the easiest way to keep the paint off of her. So now I'm going to run through rather quickly some of these first paintings that I show are all her early things from the very early 1940s. This is simply called the wash day. Now you'll see the difference if you look at them now in the gallery in her approach to paint. These are much looser, and she's all in the later ones you'll see she developed almost stylized symbols to represent people, trees, houses, churches, and things of that sort. But these early ones were much freer. This one is called Blind Man's Bluff, and it is on paper. This was done in the very early 1940s. This is another early 1940s called Mary and the Baby Jesus and the Butterfly Lily. Those big tall flower spikes are butterfly lilies that grow very profusely, or did grow around this plantation house, and they bloom in August and September, and the blossoms are quite small. The foliage is very lush, and the aroma from these little blossoms is really just marvelous and to smell. So this was done again. She did a number of religious ones, of course. And this, as far as I know, is her earliest angel. You'll see in the next thing how angels change. She put more clothes on, and the hair stands straight up in a peak, almost like a witch's sister, just a nativity thing. This, I believe, was done in the late 60s or early 70s. And she was asked once why she did this other hairstyle on all the angels. And her reply was, well, if you were flying through the air, your hair stand on the end too. And here's an early flower, a flower of no particular denomination whatsoever, but probably based on Venice, which always grew in profusion in the summertime. This is called Uncle Israel and Aunt Jane. The man standing in the foreground and the woman back of him were the two last living slaves that lived on Melrose Plantation. And this is interesting to me from not only a document of that time, they died in the late 20s or early 30s. She is remembering both of them by painting here. So birds flying around are martins, which we even have up here, but they have many more in the south. Everybody has a martin bird house. And those little egg-framed things are chicken coops. The hen stayed inside, and the biddies ran in and out when they were small, so the hen couldn't drag them through the wet grass, and they'd all die. And you don't see this anymore at all. And I think this is one of the interesting things about Tennyson's work, because she has documented a time period in this particular section of Louisiana that no longer exists. Here's another, Mary and the Baby Jesus, that many people think that he's the